human beings to grapple with ideas and to be challenged by them and to be moved by them. So for these next weeks, we will continue the Sermon on the Mount. We started last year and we didn't get very far last time. But I just wanted to go back and tell you that the introduction to the Sermon on the Mount, which is in Matthew chapter 5:6-7, with a sort of an introductory setting in the fourth chapter, where Matthew tells us that Jesus traveled all over Galilee, teaching the synagogue of Galilee, and preaching the good news of the kingdom of God, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. And as a consequence, his fame spread throughout all Syria. Now that in itself is interesting because Syria was way up north. And great crowds of people followed him from Galilee and the capital of Jerusalem and Judea from beyond the Jordan. Then Matthew records an interesting reaction or response of Jesus. He says that when Jesus saw the crowd, he went up on the mountain. Now I would like to ask you, come on, we need to have input from now and then from your side. Why do you think that Jesus reacted in this way? High up on seeing the crowd, do you think he climbed the mountain? You know, I like to see the auditorium filled. I always enjoy it when my classes are I'm one of the first to fill up. evangelists like crowd. The bigger the crowd, the better. Now here we see Jesus looking at the crowd, and what did he do? He went up on the mountain.
Well, I thought about this a lot when we were in Africa, because we were in a situation where there were two doctors and lots of patients. And I remember a couple of times coming into my office and just being overwhelmed with, you know, 150 moms and little kids, and they're all crowding around me and holding the children up to me, "Doc, you know, please do something." And I felt like, how, there's just no way that I can treat all these children. I just can't get to them physically. And I thought back to Jesus and the crowd, and I thought about how did he handle the emotional stress of knowing he could cure all those kids, all those people, that he didn't do it, and having them there in front of him all the time? Now, I'm not saying that I think he went up to the mountain to escape, but maybe he did.
All right, too. Yeah, there you go. Ears and open hearts who were ready to take in and to work out in their life what Jesus had said. It was addressed to people who had stepped over the line, so to speak. The people who had chosen to make Jesus their Lord and Master. People who had chosen to submit to his teaching. It is important, I think, also to understand that the Sermon on the Mount was never intended as a blueprint for society at large. But it is a blueprint for that special society of men and women, boys and girls, people of all ages and countries and cultures who have freely and gladly submitted themselves to God's King and the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Thus, as we continue our study of the Sermon on the Mount, it is worthwhile, I think, asking ourselves very quietly but sincerely, am I a disciple of Jesus? Do I even want to be his disciple? Am I willing to do, or at least try to do, really do, what he said? And so then the Sermon on the Mount becomes life-changing for us all. When Jesus came to the spot he had in mind, he took the posture of a teacher. That is, he sat down, quite different from what I'm doing right now. And those who had followed waited breathlessly to hear what he said. Do you think that they were surprised by what he said? Stunned, perhaps? Disappointed? Frightened, awed, challenged. Perhaps each person shared some of these emotions, and maybe some of them shared all of them together. But on the whole, I think that as Jesus continued to teach and they to listen, they began to sense that as upsetting as his words were, they were right on. However contrary they seemed to ordinary human values and practices, they were right values and right practices. These listeners began to sense that what Jesus said made sense, that his teaching harmonized with the universe, with the way the world was made by God to go, that his words describe what goes into making life a truly blessed, fortunate, happy, useful, productive, good life. Jesus began the sermon by what we call Beatitudes, and I'm sort of quickly going over this because this was already covered last year, although we may all have forgotten it. But we go back and read. He began the sermon with what we call the Beatitudes, blessed, happy, fortunate, Makarios, however we're going to translate that wonderful, wonderful Greek word. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers.
You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. What confidence Jesus had in his disciples. What a stupendous confidence he paid them. You are salt and light. Two great metaphors for the Christian disciples. Two indispensable things in this world. Two things, if you will notice, that work by sacrificing and giving themselves. Two very different things, but with one thing in common. They give. They give of themselves to preserve, to retard corruption, to season, to make life more palatable, to sustain life, to push back the darkness of evil, to give positive, trustworthy direction to life, to dispel ignorance, to provide cheer in an otherwise cheerless world. Some giving themselves in a quiet, unobtrusive, unseen way, like Saul, and others in an open, more prominent, more public way, like life. You, said Jesus, are soft and life. And then he shifted his emphasis from us to himself. In verses 5, 7, and chapter 5, 17, 20. And we learn that he did not come to do away with the law or to abolish it. Now, for many, they're certainly being adults both by myself, who have been brought up in the brethren tradition, as I have from my ancestors way back. That seems like bad news, my brethren. Because I was brought up on that song, and I don't think it's been on Wimbledon any longer, but it was, and it's what we used to have here. Free from the law. Oh, joyous condition. Jesus has fled, and there is remission. Cursed by the law, bruised by the law, grace hath redeemed us from the law. Free from the law. So, for a long time, I was very dubious about Jesus' words. And I said, well, it certainly can't be teaching for this day. This is the day of grace and not of law. And yet Jesus said, I came not to do away with the law or the prophets. But I want you to know that to those who first heard Jesus' words, when they heard him say that, it was not bad news to them. That was good news. For they loved the law of God. It gave direction to their lives and meaning. And some of the things that they must have heard about Jesus and the things reported that he had said made them afraid. Had he come to undermine, undercut, abolish God's law? So, with his words now, he set their hearts at ease. They just sort of went to sleep, I guess. No. I have not come to destroy the law, he said, but I've come to fulfill the law. Now, I'd like to ask you, please, if you would chime in. What do you think Jesus meant by this? I've not come to abolish the law or criticize even. I think we can understand that, but what did he mean by I have come to fulfill the law? So, okay, and for you all here, we want to be able to speak loudly enough so everybody can hear. He said that before Christ came, the law was a burden to us, huh? But when Christ came, then it had become the law of God. Alright, and the other response is this. What did Jesus mean by when he said, I've come not to abolish it, but to fulfill the law?
I can't see you because the line is just terrible over there. Because of Dan and Bob's position before Christ's king, there really was not a person that could have lost the law. It was really too perfect. So he was finally a person who could actually live and fulfill Christ's king.
Alright, here was a person who could live and fulfill God's commandments. The commandments in essence were fulfilled in him. I Friday night. Come here and all the food is good. Anything else? May I ask one thing more then? See, my husband, and I rather think he did, now that this is not to discount anything that has been said, because it has been very helpful. That he was going to fulfill the law, and that he would clarify his intent, draw out its true need, go beyond the externals to the real heart of any given law. He was going to look not only at the words of the law and what the law said, but at the spirit which lay behind the word of any given law. I think this is not to be taken into consideration, because we notice what immediately followed, and this brings us then to our study for this morning. Matthew 5:21-26. We'll concentrate on this in the remaining moments. Will somebody read for us, please? Matthew 5:21-26. Read it loudly enough so everybody can hear. Maybe stand in.
You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder. Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. And yet, anyone who says to his brother, I have, is answerable to say to you. Anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, to kill an offering, to give it the altar, and never remember that your brother has something against you. Eager to get there, in front of the altar. First go to be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Very while you are still living in the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last.
Thank you very much. Now, what Jesus does here, and in the following verses, is take the word of the law and push it to its limit to tell us what it really means. He brings us face to face with the higher righteousness, with that righteousness which must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And we learn that Jesus' commands are far more radical than Moses' commands. Moses said, no murder. What did Jesus say? No anger. The difference between the two is very important. The Ten Commandments, for instance, seemingly are concerned only with people's outward actions. Or at least they could be understood in that way, and probably were by many people. The Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount, are clearly concerned with people's inmost feelings and desires in life. The Ten Commandments, it seems, would be satisfied if we abstain from murder, from adultery, etc. No matter however much we wanted to do either or both. The Sermon on the Mount says that what we want to do is equally as important as what we do, even if we don't do it. Thoughts and feelings are every bit as important as deeds and actions. The only way to be safe, really safe and good, is not only to do what is right, but to want to do what is right. Aeschylus was one of the great ancient playwrights who wrote in Greek, no less. not wish to appear good, but to be good. And this is what Jesus is saying. And so we come to the first of six antitheses. The law said, but I said. And when he gives that little introduction, but I say, he takes the law to its highest degree. The Jews in Jesus' day rated offense. There were the ordinary offenses that could be decided by the local court. And then there were special offenses that required the council, the central court, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, I guess we would say in our country, to decide these things. And then there were the ultimate of offenses, the really bad ones, that only God could decide, and which would end in the worst kind of punishment ever. And at first glance, it would appear that Jesus' words are to be understood similarly. Anger makes one liable to judgment. Raka, to call someone a rocket, that's what it means, puts one in jeopardy of the decision of the Supreme Court. And to say, you fool, Trenton's one was ultimate judgment. My own understanding is different from this, however. One, because for Jesus, sin is sin, and all sin is a nullity and offense against God, whether we realize it or not. Two, because it is difficult, if not impossible, to make out any corresponding climax to these three offenses that Jesus lists here. How is it possible, I ask you, how is it possible to show that calling a person a fool is immensely worse than calling another person a blockhead? As much worse as the difference between being stoned to death, a decision of the council, and suffering eternal perdition, the decision of God. Three, because I think that Jesus is simply making use of a rhetorical device called hyperbole, using a multiple of clauses substantially equivalent in meaning, though dissimilar in form, to highlight, underscore, emphasize one single idea. And it is this, that the law of God, properly understood, not only forbids the act, but the attitude behind the act. No offense was brought to trial under Jewish law that was not a sin of act. I don't know about contemporary law, but we have a lawyer here instead of lawyer. But now, Jesus raises the whole level of culpability, of liability, to extreme heights. The way Jesus deals with the law, and here especially with the law of murder, is to go behind the specific word or command to the principle that underlines it. Here he says that you, and remember now, he's speaking to us, to his disciple. Are you his disciple? Am I his disciple? He speaks to us and says, you are to consider anger against someone. Anger that smolders and burns within you. Anger that sometimes blazes out in insulting language and hurtful words. Anger in any form, as those under the law of Moses were accustomed to think of homicide. You, my disciple, must not think that the law, even the Old Testament law, is adequately kept just because no blood is spilled. You must understand that the law, when it is understood, really understood, points to a more fundamental problem, to the angry view, the hateful thought, the bitter attitude, the wish to strike out and strike down the object of our enemy. And it is this that Jesus says must be judged and removed from ourselves if we are indeed His followers. Now, two questions arise in my mind immediately. And I need help on this, please. Although I have thought through and have some answers, but I would like to hear it full. Why does Jesus do this to us? Why does He raise the level of culpability, of liability, from that of the act to that of the attitude, from murder to anger? Is this an unreasonable demand and impossible one? Why have you?
You just answered it. You want us to make it as impossible as impossible.
Wow, I didn't answer it.
Because it's absolutely necessary for us to understand that, as you were saying earlier, that our motive is not one motive within any of us that's perfectly pure. Therefore, none of us can stand in our actions before God and say, I am.
That's the point.
all these wonderful minds? Well, there's at least one other thing that I've reminded. I think everything that we've said this morning is so very important and should be taken in and digested and thought about. And I hope that this isn't the end of our thinking about this tremendously important passage. But I think there's another one, and I think we'll get to that perhaps in what Bert said. But, you know, I think Jesus was concerned about us personally. He wasn't only telling us, you know, you can never be good enough in yourself, you've got to depend upon God. I think to some extent that's true. I'm very good with that. But I think Jesus was concerned about us personally, as individuals. And he knew so clearly the destructiveness of anger and bitterness and resentment and malicious to the person who is angry. I recall vividly the anger that stormed up within me against my department chairman many years ago when he tried his best not only to remove me from his department, but to get me dismissed from the college as well. You know, it's pretty hard to get dismissed from the college when you're attending. Well, my anger was so great and my resentment so deep that you know what happened? I became seriously ill and was born for that. Jesus wants us to be well. He wants us to be whole, wholesome people, not people who destroy ourselves with anger. And so he was trying to tell us how off anger is. And he is so severe because he knows, as David pointed out, that the thought is the parent of the act. If we permit anger to grow within us, it can obsess us and eventually control our actions that are often destructive actions to the object. And Jesus not only wants us to be healed people, but what? He wants us also to be healing people. Healers of other people. And how can we do that? With our anger. The other question that comes to my mind is, what can I do? How can I rid myself of anger? Which seemingly is so much a part of being human. How can I overcome those hostile feelings that automatically rise up within me because of some wrong done to me, some insult, some injury done to my ego? What's that? How? Give me help. How can I overcome that? Go talk to the one who's in your anger. Well, I've been an angry person for years. And when I was asked to do the Sermon on the Mount, or when I was asked to teach this class again, and I decided I was going to do the Sermon on the Mount, I happened to reread it. I really read this section. And so the first thing I had to do was write four letters to people who I was very angry. I'm sorry, Frank, I didn't do what you suggest. Go to it, but I probably would have been the best one. Okay. Go to the first one. This is quiet. This group has been yet.
Very intense situation for people who are problems that are very angry. I think we have one option. Another way to do it is to divert your attention to something that's more meaning or the purpose of sin.
Yeah, it's definitely very important, man.
You don't repress it or deny it. It's a reality, but it's not a controlling reality. It's there, but also it's another reality too. If there's something at work happens, I'm very angry about it. I've got home, I've got a family, a wife, a husband, and children.
He has to be in a
mountain. That's not a little girl, I'm not sure. We have to incorporate anything, any situation in the rest of the house. And when that becomes, or when one problem becomes our central focus, it serves our whole perception of reality. Like, we know what's changed the house.
Everyone,
that
answers
important,
please.
Yeah. I think as you mentioned that, often it's hard to identify, but it's important to identify motive and then open it up. Whether it's the person has a motive against, or whether it's to someone close, whether it's motive rather than help. And I think the third thing is, not to allow paralyzing. Sometimes we find ourselves that we become introspective and thinking about the circumstances. We so question our own motives, or even worse yet, question someone else's motives, that it becomes a problem with action. And that is probably the crude ultimate of the damnation.
I think sometimes it's difficult to identify that anger and sin because he's so justified. So a person has motives to identify it as sin. Regardless of what the other person has done, what we are doing is wrong. Well, that means getting on our knees before the Lord and he can be very gracious. He can change by it.
I got to challenge that a little bit because I think that there is some anger that is not sin. Also, on the anger he was in,
okay, good. Just tackle on that perhaps probably that he's far more able than I. But, you know, in preparing for today, I went through the New Testament. And there are almost every instance of anger is a no-no for a Christian. It's classified with all other kinds of things you would want to be even associated with. And even the passage that you mentioned, the only concession I can find is the passage you mentioned as far as the followers of Jesus is concerned. And even then, it concludes with these words, "Don't let the sun go down on the anger." So, get rid of it somehow or other. Okay, I kind of about found me. Those are really good answers. And I feel that there probably aren't any instances where anger is justified. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that the emphasis on the New Testament seems to be just the opposite. Recognize that. Ask God to forgive. Don't nurse it. These are things that occur. Replace the hostile, bitter thought with friendly, positive thought. Attempt, even with a struggle, to do some helpful or kind act to the person who hurts you. Take the initiative to restore the vision. And above all, I think it's been referred to, remember that the Christian gospel, and has any truth to it at all, says that these new laws of Jesus, we put it that way, are accompanied by a supernatural power within to help us on to a realization and actualization of these laws in our lives. So, let's not be afraid to call on God, on the Spirit of God, for help. And that.
standard which is so that we follow along and fulfill our aspirations.